Hello. Welcome to Razor's Edge, local and independent current affairs straight from Sydney on 2SER 107.3. I'm Daniel Butler. Today on the show...
Art is one of the ways in which we tell complex stories about a whole range of emotions, from love to grief to anguish, and we can also tell these stories about mental health.
It's World Mental Health Day, and all this month, the Big Anxiety Festival will be holding events across Sydney that aim to inspire discussions around mental health through art. Also on the show today...
Business is saying climate change is real, it's upon us, and we have legal and moral obligations to deal with it.
Hard to mistake that voice. Former New South Wales Premier Bob Carr came into the 2SER studios to discuss climate change, politics and protest. All of that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first, the international climate change group known as the Extinction Rebellion is currently organising strikes around the world, including here in Sydney. About 45 protesters from the Extinction Rebellion have been arrested across Sydney this week as they were sitting down in the middle of roads and blocking traffic at Broadway and at the University of Technology, Sydney. These protesters are asking the government for immediate climate change solutions. Ellie Baxter, public representative of the Extinction Rebellion Sydney, spoke to Lewis Ribera for this report.
Can you tell us how and when the Extinction Rebellion international movement was first established in Sydney?
Extinction Rebellion kicked off in Sydney in April with a small number of people who declared themselves in rebellion over the climate crisis. At that time, it was still very small, and I think we saw a big surge in numbers following the federal election when people realised that we had a government that had been elected who would willfully refuse to act on climate change. And I think many people realised that it was the time to step up and take direct action.
What is the main focus of this movement?
Extinction Rebellion has three very clear demands. Our first demand is that governments tell the truth to the community about the extent of the climate and ecological crisis and declare a climate emergency. Our second demand is that they act now to reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2025. And our third demand is that they establish a citizens' assembly, which would be a representative body of ordinary, everyday Australians who would decide on the policies that would take us to that net zero emissions target, rather than relying on the governments who we've seen are entirely in the thrall of fossil fuel industries.
Some see the activists displayed a bee emergency protest. Can you tell us what this protest was about?
So Extinction Rebellion Sydney declared a bee emergency on Tuesday morning. We had some fantastic beekeepers from the mid-north coast come to Sydney to work with us for that event. This was to highlight the incredible impact of the climate and ecological breakdown on bees. What we're seeing is that bees are suffering colony collapse, loss of habitat, and increasing susceptibility to disease due to this emergency. In the United States, they've lost 30% of their bee population just in the last few years. And we have similar rates of loss here in Australia. And what's so important about bees is that they are the pollinators that get out there and help and support our crops. Without bees, our farmers simply cannot support the food needs of our nation. So unless we really turn these things around, bring those emissions under control, we are going to lose those bee populations, which will make it extraordinarily difficult for us to produce enough food for humans to eat.
It has been reported that about 35 Extinction Rebellion activists were arrested on Broadway. Can you tell us why these people got arrested?
So these rebels chose to get arrested. They chose to lie down in the street and not comply with police directions to move on. And they chose to do that because they know how serious the climate and ecological emergency is. They know that we are facing the sixth mass extinction, and that without very urgent change, the planet simply won't be habitable for humans in the not-too-distant future. And they feel it's their moral responsibility to take a stand, and they are willing to sacrifice their personal liberty to do that.
Are members encouraged to get arrested?
No, I wouldn't say members are encouraged. The arrests are part of Extinction Rebellion's strategy. People who choose to be arrested are trained. We do workshops on nonviolent direct action. They're given legal information. They're given briefings on what to expect once they're arrested. So there's certainly space for it, but there is absolutely no pressure on anyone to get arrested. You know, the example on Monday, there were 500 people at the protest. There were more than 30 arrests. So that's a hell of a lot of people who just packed up their flags and went home afterwards.
In regards to activists who get arrested, does the movement provide any type of support?
Yes. So we're very committed to taking care of people who have been arrested. That process starts as soon as before they're arrested. We have legal observers at all of our actions who are there to record what's happening. They then have our legal support group who they can contact when they're in custody, who work very hard to make sure that they have the right information and that their rights are not being violated. And we also have arrestee support. So we have a group of people who will sit outside any police station where a rebel is being held, and they'll wait there until they're released with hugs and snacks and water and lots of looking after them.
Does the movement have specific rules for its members?
We don't have specific rules. We have 10 values and principles. I won't go through all of them because that would take a while, but they're on the website, and I would really encourage anyone who's interested in Extinction Rebellion to read those values and principles. And we're a decentralized self-organizing movement. So anyone can have a look at those demands, agree with them, agree with the values and principles, and they can act in the name of Extinction Rebellion.
Are there any Australian public figures who are part of this movement?
Former Green Senator Scott Ludlam was arrested as part of the action on Broadway on Monday. So he's definitely involved. And we've also seen, you know, other people come out within the media. So we're definitely growing.
When will the protests conclude in Sydney?
The final action we have planned in Sydney is for Sunday. That will be a completely non-disruptive action. We are making our hourglass symbol on Bondi Beach with our bodies, and that will be a beautiful event that people are more than welcome to come along to. There'll be some fantastic speakers talking about ocean ecology, and that will be our final event for Spring Rebellion. But stay tuned, there'll be more to come.
Ellie Baxter there, public representative of the Extinction Rebellion Sydney movement, and in that report by Luis Ribera.
Christmas comes with a rich musical stew.
Who's gonna make the gravy?
Paul Kelly returns, making gravy this festive season.
Have a Merry Christmas!
Together with Courtney Barnett, Kate Miller-Heidke, Marlon Williams, and Thelma Plum.
Later in the evening.
Saturday, December 14, in the Domain. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster. Frontier Touring sponsors 2SER.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Well, today's World Mental Health Day, a day which aims to raise awareness and reduce the stigma around mental illness. Also this month, the Big Anxiety Festival is hosting events and art exhibitions across Sydney that aim to provoke discussion and empathy around mental health issues. Kate Atkinson spoke to Beck Dean, the director of the festival, about how art can be used to improve mental well-being.
Today we're actually collaborating with Lifeline, and so we're working with the Lifeline volunteers actually to bring these conversations into the public domain, and potentially to invite people who might be passing by to have these conversations maybe at an earlier stage, I guess, than they would be in terms of calling someone from Lifeline. So I guess the idea with Lifeline collaborating with us kind of artistically is to bring this into a space that has a kind of aesthetic treatment that is attractive to people.
And so I guess connecting it to art and something more visual and aesthetic, maybe, is that one of the ways to break down the barriers that people may experience when they try to start talking about mental health?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the idea of the festival is kind of based on, there's a whole range of researchers working with us as well, and we're partnering with Black Dog. And I guess one of the kind of guiding principles of our festival is that we are attuned to this notion that there are a lot of people out there who don't seek help and who don't go through the normal channels, I guess, or the health-based channels. And art is one of the ways in which we tell complex stories, and we tell complex stories about a whole range of emotions, from love to grief to anguish, and we can also tell these stories about mental health through that. And so one of the things that we do is actually work with people with lived experience. And a lot of the artists in the festival are artists with lived experience of mental health, and with lived experience of all sorts of kind of marginalised experiences that lead them to be stigmatised in the community and that lead to other sorts of mental health concerns.
Art and technology and like creative expression can help initiate conversations, but does the process of making art also contribute to mental well-being?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I've been working with artists who are patients in the kind of hospital systems quite a long time, and it's certainly something that continues to come up, that art making actually is enormously conducive to feelings of well-being. And, you know, just 2 days ago, our friends at Long Bay Correctional Facility opened an exhibition which is at the Boomgate Gallery in Long Bay, and all of the art inside that gallery is made by inmates. And the exhibition reflects very deeply upon, and a lot of the inmates have given testimony about the importance of art in their sense of well-being and in their rehabilitation, in their kind of ability to sort of keep going and to strive for something better, is through this capacity to make art within the context of that jail system. So I think it's one of those things that's very important that we understand that art can do these things, and the scientists that we're working with are also telling us these stories as well, and there are kind of there is a lot of scientific evidence around the use of art as a tool for increasing the sense of well-being.
So why do you think art in itself has such a positive effect for mental health?
I guess because it involves us in a range of other kinds of experiences without, you know, having to be sort of transported physically. And I think art has always had that potential. It's, you know, everything that we know about the beginnings of art are around, you know, its use in ceremony. I mean, and these things sort of continue today. But we have, you know, I think most of us that have these kinds of experiences with art, for myself, you know, to experience this kind of sense of connection to something that is kind of beyond my own day-to-day. So I think it's really about, you know, making sort of connections that are bigger than your sort of physical experience.
Do you think art and creative expression is becoming a common way for young people to deal with their mental health issues and emotions?
Well, we've just done a great project in St Leonard's with the Bradfield College, and
they worked with an artist, Cameron Cripps Kennedy, and poet Omar Saka. And it was basically about bringing their mental health experiences into public conversation. So they've been doing work that brings poetry about sort of complex, private, hidden experiences of mental health and disability into the public space. And the feedback we've got from them is quite phenomenal actually, because I think poetry is a very, also another, like drawing, it's something that if you have the skills, if you develop the skills around poetry, you actually have this very immediate form to work with, just you and a pencil and a piece of paper. And in doing this work and sharing these words, I think it's been very important for the students that participated in the project.
You mentioned about the skill of poetry. Do you have to be good at art and creative work to reach the benefits of it?
I don't think so. You know, we learn that these things have enormous kind of cognitive effects. You know, in studies on Alzheimer's, it's kind of noted that if someone takes up a skill from like of drawing or painting or art making, even late in life can have enormous benefits on your sort of developing new sort of neural pathways. So I don't think it's I don't think that is so important. I think, you know, there's space for everyone in artistic practice, and you know, the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
Beck Dean there, the director of the Big Anxiety Festival, ending that report by Kate Atkinson. British Masters New Order, who changed pop music forever, announce a rare Sydney performance. Celebrating a 40-year, 10-album career, they bring their adored repertoire to Horton Pavilion on March 11, joined by Confidence Man. New Order, as timeless and essential as ever. Tickets on sale Tuesday, October 15 from Ticketek. Penny Drop and Chug Entertainment sponsored 2SER.
On Saturday, October 26, 2SER celebrates 40 years of real radio at the Back to Funk Barbecue Sessions, featuring heaps of your favourite 2SER DJs. Meme, Shan Frenzy, Paris Groove Scooter, Pete and EO, Trevor Parkey, Foreign Dub DJs, Lorna, Lyndon Pike and Hoba Mallow. We'll be broadcasting the barbecue live on 2SER. Come celebrate this milestone of Sydney music history with us. The Back to Funk 2SER 40th Birthday Special Barbecue Session. Saturday, October 26 at the Vic on the Park, Marrickville. And live on 2SER 107.3.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, of which sovereignty was never ceded. Bob Carr is New South Wales' longest-serving Premier and something of a Labor legend. He came into 2SER for a wide-ranging discussion, including the Extinction Rebellion we just heard a report on, how politicians should react to such protests, and how to successfully guide politicians and voters towards a just transition from fossil fuels. Rod Chambers spoke to Mr. Carr for this interview.
Yeah, it's about the interaction of climate, climate policy, climate action, and business. One of the things that has struck me is that despite what the federal government says, business is saying climate change is real, it's upon us, and we have legal and moral obligations to deal with it. And there is a great deal of business-related, business-driven innovation. And if we're going to save ourselves from that, the degradation of the environment that comes with 1.5 degrees warming on top of where we are now, you're going to need that innovation, and it comes from business, and it comes from business saying we're not interested in denialism, this is real, we've got to be prepared, and that's happening.
And so, you know, do you feel the people that are at around the CBD and Central Station at the moment with the Extinction Rebellion, do you think they're on the money about this as well?
if I were young, I'd be in the streets saying, this is real. I'm going to be alive, I hope, towards the end of this century. I've got to take seriously the science that is in, the science that comes from very serious sources, the science that emerges, for example, from NASA, the science that is endorsed by the US Defense Department when it's projecting what threats lie to the United States and its interests decades into the future. We've got to take this seriously. And young people are entitled to say we've still got denialism clouding the government perspective, and the government is not leading the way it should. I think for the Prime Minister to say, and I've got no political bias when I state this position, to say that plastic is a bigger problem than the shift in climate is deeply disturbing. It justifies and vindicates what young people are doing by saying, look, we're going to stick this in front of you with a demonstration.
If you're a politician in Australia today and you've got to do something about what is, you know, our number two money earner, coal, how do you convince people that they've got to make some sort of sacrifice? It's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
It is, and that's what I'm exploring in this role, and I've got a forum on at UTS on October 11.
Which is this coming Friday?
This coming Friday in the afternoon, and anyone's welcome to come along to Building 1, Level 22, where I've got two very interesting panellists, Rebecca Huntley and John Connor, with a background in this very area, exploring what language we should use in persuading Australians to move. A lot of Australians are persuaded, of course, but how do you pitch a message to coal mining communities or to employees of a coal-fired, big old-fashioned coal-fired power plant? Is the word transition too difficult? Should we be talking about economic diversification in these regions, for example? How do you persuade conservatives to move with you? Rebecca was telling me about a story in the United States of the biggest bird watching society in the country getting mobilized to talk to governors and others about, and senators, about climate change. And they found that talking about an imminent catastrophe was not helpful. But reducing something to a local problem, saving a habitat to save local bird life, and at the same time make an investment in beating climate change, that could mobilise conservative, perhaps Republican voting Americans who like watching birds. And
they also like hunting, unfortunately, too, don't
they? Yeah, they do, yeah. So. you could play with the challenge of persuading American hunters that unless they protect habitats, hunting opportunities are going to be diminished
decline, yes,
for their youngsters, and they want to pass on responsible recreational gun use for hunting to their youngsters. It's part of an American tradition, and reflects an argument we had here when we bought out fishers who were commercially fishing in the big estuaries up and down the New South Wales coast. We bought them out. They were happy to take the money and to wrap up their commercial activities. But that led to a colossal increase in fish life and created opportunities for recreational shooting. You could pitch an argument about environmental action that helps on climate to hunters who want opportunities for hunting by saving habitats.
You must have had a lot of experience with this when you started off as the Environment Minister in New South Wales, because with all the national parks you were bringing on board, must have affected loggers and so forth, did it?
I ended up as Premier restructuring forestry to liberate us, to declare, it's an astonishing number even when I pronounce it, a total of 350 new national parks over the 10 years I was Premier. Mm. Someone told me, and I'm not going to be vainglorious enough to assert this too broadly, that there's no jurisdiction in the world where there's been 350 new national parks declared in a decade. So I'm very proud of that. But we only did it because we were able to vault over the deadlock that had loggers and environmentalists at one another's throats and introduce a new policy that restructured the timber industry. We paid old ailing mills to go out of business. They weren't viable anyway. They were just hanging on. And gave good retirement packages to the relatively small number of workers who were employed in them, and helped the viable mills with money to upgrade their operations and gave them continuity of timber supply. And that enabled us to get out of old growth logging in New South Wales and create some glorious national parks, Tantawangalo and Coolangubra in the Southeast Forest. I remember one day signing a bit of paper that created 100 new parks between Jervis Bay and the Bega Valley.
That's a lot.
It was, and some
in
of them
one were, day. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It made me. It gives me an example to quote of the advantage of political action. What you can do in a political career.
Former New South Wales Premier Bob Carr there, ending that interview with Rod Chambers. Well, that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Catch us again next week on Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. I'm Daniel Butler. Till next time.